It's the confluence where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. In 1987, Marty Ashby was working for the Pittsburgh Symphony Orchestra when he was introduced to the newly completed Vocational Education and Arts Center at Manchester Craftsmen's Guild on Pittsburgh's North Side. It changed his life, and he, in turn, helped to change Pittsburgh's cultural landscape. During the next 31 years, Marty, an executive producer of MCG Jazz, has produced thousands of concerts and scores of albums, including 5 Grammy winners. Recently, 90.5 WESA's Bob Studebaker visited Marty at Manchester Craftsmen's Guild to discuss his passion for an art form which has a rich history here in Pittsburgh.
Marty, thank you for taking the time to show me around and talk a bit about how Manchester Craftsmen's Guild works to foster an environment for not just today's jazz artists, but also for the artists of the future who learn the music and the culture of jazz here. And central to what I'd like to focus on, documenting the remarkable history of artists who started in Pittsburgh and went on to literally change the world of music. And while that's been achieved in many different ways over the decades, the TV documentary, which debuted earlier this year, about the unique role Pittsburgh has played, has put our city's story into a wonderful form and allowed people all over the country, and the world really, to learn about what happened and continues to happen here. At Manchester Craftsmen's Guild's website, the mission statement is pretty front and center: to preserve, present, and to promote jazz.
Yeah, what we've been trying to do here since 1987 is to do just that, to preserve and present and promote the music. It's a litmus test that makes it very easy for me to decide what to do every day. Because if something comes across my desk, if it doesn't match our mission to really cherish this music and the musicians that create the music and try to create audience for this music at the same time, if it doesn't do one of those things, then we don't do it, quite frankly. And it's been, it's been a thrill to have, as you look at the wall here, man, you see all these photos of the great musicians over the last 32 years. We lived in a very special time, Bob, because we were at the end of the primary resources for this music. So if you look around, you see Dave Brubeck, you see Dizzy Gillespie, you see Carmen McRae, you see Max Roach, right? You see Billy Taylor, you see all these great artists.
And you see a lot of Pittsburghers, too. I'm looking at Ray Brown right now. There's Stanley Turrentine, Johnny Costa up there.
Over the last 32 years, as I was saying, the primary resources for this music were all here. And it's been a real honor to kind of be part of that, to be with the last of the folks that created the music that we call jazz from, you know, the late 30s and the 40s, that they were here in one spot to celebrate this music in a meaningful way. And the exciting thing for me is, you know, now that a lot of those resources are gone, there's only a handful you can go to that are in their late 80s or 90s.
You talked about the legacy of jazz, and of course, as Pittsburghers, many of us are aware of the incomparable legacy of jazz in Pittsburgh. That was captured in the documentary that you were the executive producer of. And the title, I loved the title, I thought it was great. We Knew What We Had, The Greatest Jazz Story Never Told. And did Nelson Harrison come up with that title? It sounds like something that I can hear him say.
Yeah, Dr. Harrison coined the phrase, "We Knew What We Had." Absolutely, and we added the tagline about the greatest jazz story never told, because indeed, it is a story that so many folks just didn't know about. In fact, when musicians come here and we start talking about the Pittsburghers, you know, the Errol Garners and the Ahmad Jamals and the Billy Strayhorns and on and on and on with the list, they say, they didn't all come from Pittsburgh. And I said, yeah, man, they did. And it was really the impetus for us. It took 10 years to make the film. We got started, then we got stopped, we got started, we got stopped. And finally, some 62 interviews later, we were able to craft and profile just 15 artists. I mean, there's a lot of folks we didn't get to. But it really tells the story, I think, of how the timing all came together and the uniqueness of Pittsburgh because of its culture, because of its educational system, because of the topography of Pittsburgh had a lot to do with it, because of the working class nature, because of the philanthropic nature of Pittsburgh. All these things come together and have given and have provided the opportunity for this music to grow and be nurtured here in a way that, frankly, I haven't seen in any other city in the way that it was done here in Pittsburgh.
One of the things that I noticed early on when I became aware of the story of jazz in Pittsburgh was how, as jazz evolved, anybody can conjure up an audio image in their minds of the original sound of jazz, the kind of 5 and 7 piece ensemble riffing. And it didn't stay that way. Every 5 to 7 years, maybe, there was a point of departure into a new type of jazz. And so many times the catalyst for that change was somebody from Pittsburgh, the father of modern jazz piano being Earl Father Hines. And he left here in 1920, headed off to Chicago, met a kid newly out of New Orleans named Armstrong, and they made great stuff together. Mary Lou Williams, after that, a giant of the swing era. And then the drummers who came and helped make jazz go into so much more of a sophisticated direction. Can you tell me, I'll ask you to take the story from there.
Yeah, there's so many stories. You can take pretty much any instrument group and you can talk about how a Pittsburgher had a significant influence on the direction, the history, the change forever in this music. We're looking at a photo of Stanley Turrentine right now, and Stanley was one of those artists that had a knack of incorporating kind of a bluesy R&B sound into what was at the time kind of contemporary mainstream jazz. And there's not a saxophone player out there today that you hear a hoop-doop lick and you say, he's coming out of Stanley, right? You take Art Blakey, of course, the great bebop drummer, jazz drummer. You hear certain patterns that musicians play, drummers play, and you say, oh, that's a Blakey thing. And it goes on and on. It doesn't matter who it is. Of course, one of the folks that are still with us would be Ahmad Jamal. And Ahmad had such a style, such a character, such a unique presence, such a voice that is undeniable. You hear 3 or 4 notes of him playing, you say, that's Ahmad Jamal. Just like George Benson. And George is one of those that changed the music forever.
Yeah, Benson, of course, is a guy who took jazz to millions of people who didn't otherwise have it because he was in a pop venue and he had mega hits. If you judge Pittsburgh artists simply by the number of records sold, nobody comes close to Benson.
Yeah, George is a unique spirit, a unique voice, a unique combination of elements within the music that just really took off. He came at the right time at the right place. He was able to take, his kind of R&B, his voice, and his guitar playing is off the hook. And he's really very connected in a deep emotional way to Pittsburgh. When we finally were able to connect with him at his house in Phoenix to do the interview, his handler said, well, you got 20 minutes. And I figured that's okay, because I knew it was the last interview we did for the film. And I knew kind of what we needed to get him to talk about to be part of the film. And the first question that I asked him, about 30 minutes later, we went on to the next question. And about 2 hours later, he said, is there anything else you want to ask me? He was very gracious, loved talking about Pittsburgh, talking about he and Roger Humphreys, where it was, little Georgie Benson and little Roger Humphreys at the same time. A great story I have to tell people. About Joe Negri. So George came back to town, apparently. I'm not sure what year this was. Joe was on Mr. Rogers at the time, and Joe was Joe Negri. And he came back to town, and for whatever reason, they were going to go to the Grill.
Yeah, of course, you mean the Crawford Grill, the legendary place in the Hill District.
Yes, it was legendary. So George and Joe Negri went to the Grill, and it was after he was already a big star, George Benson, and they got to the Grill. And George told me this story at his house. He said, we got there, and it was all about, Joe Negri is here. Everybody was going to say hello to Joe. George said he just kind of stood in the corner and watched everybody go to see Joe Negri. And I thought, what a delicious story, and very appropriate for Master Negri.
So the story of Pittsburgh jazz got put into a final form of a documentary that was aired in Pittsburgh in February of this year, correct? And then it was on stations across the country. It took the Pittsburgh story to the entire United States. Tell me a little bit about the the feedback you got from people in other cities who said, hey, I didn't know you had that.
Yeah, we were very fortunate to have the American Public Television Network accept the film and put it out to literally hundreds of stations. So there was over 400 stations that aired it for over 2,000 airplays around the country between February and April. It's still airing now in certain markets and will air for the next 3 years on public television. We received between February and, say, April, hundreds of emails and phone calls. I got a beautiful email from Herb Alpert, who saw the film and just raved about it. This film critic you may know, Leonard Maltin, wrote a beautiful critique of the film. He's a big jazz fan. I think one of my favorite stories is Rene Govanucci, the director of the jazz program here, got a phone call and said, we're trying to figure out how to play the film. We're out here in Los Angeles. We know it's airing. We're trying to figure out what station and how to do it. Marilyn and the Bergmans, Alan and Marilyn Bergman, were like, they're songwriters, by the way. We're saying all this to Rene. Rene lost it and said, the Bergmans want to see the film. We'll figure out how to get them to see the film. It's a great story.
A great story, which happened because of Pittsburgh's great and continuing jazz story. And I think it would be a good place here to insert this little promo for the documentary.
For a city its size, Pittsburgh has produced more jazz innovators than any other city.
That was the place to be if you want to hear some jazz.
We knew what we had. Whew, man.
And of course, Marty, I have to ask, any thoughts of doing a follow-up documentary?
So, yeah, the idea of a continuation, because the story does continue every day, let's put it this way, it's not off the radar just yet.
Thanks, Marty. With Marty Ashby at Manchester Craftsman's Guild, I'm Bob Studebaker for The Confluence.
You're listening to The Confluence.
Here's what's trending in Pittsburgh. I'm Sarah Kovash. Steelers wide receiver Antonio Brown wore a hippo costume and sang Bobby Brown's My Prerogative on TV this week. And no, he didn't lose a bet. He was a contestant on the new Fox TV show The Masked Singer, where celebrities wear costumes to shield their identities while performing a song. And the 2019 Pennsylvania Farm Show butter sculpture was unveiled yesterday. It features a half ton of butter carved into life-size figures depicting a firefighter, dairy farmer, athlete, doctor, and soldier all wearing capes. The theme of this year's sculpture is Choose PA Dairy and Find Your Power. Find more at WESA.FM.
It's The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. The city's One Pittsburgh initiative was announced last spring as a means for big nonprofits, foundations, businesses to contribute money to improve the city's social well-being, including universal pre-K education, affordable housing. We heard repeatedly through the fall that more details were due any day, and yet so far, nothing. Chris Potter, editor of WESA's government accountability team, is in studio with us. Chris, on the Confluence yesterday, Mayor Peduto hinted that it might be a while longer before we'd hear anything this year, too. You spoke to the mayor after our broadcast. What else can you tell us?
Yeah, he is not in the business of offering timelines in the way he was last year, perhaps because of the experience he had. I mean,
because he got burned.
Yeah, he was here in this studio, maybe in the very chair I sit in, saying, you know, hey, by the end of September or by the end of October, when he did his fall budget announcement, he said by the end of November. He is not putting himself in that position. He's not putting himself in that box. He told me, you know, I spoke to him after the show, as you said, and I said, you know, it sounds like you're months away from an announcement. Is that it? And he said, I assume. So this doesn't really come as a surprise, folks who heard my colleague Margaret Krause late last year report that a lot of people who are envisioned as being part of this initiative, including the foundation community, has sort of been scratching their own heads about when this was supposed to happen, what their own role was supposed to be. And I think what you heard on the air yesterday and what I heard afterwards is we are months away from any kind of announcement. And it's not clear, even when that announcement comes, whether we'll find out the thing that everybody's most curious about, which is, what's UPMC going to contribute? What's Allegheny Health and Highmark going to contribute? What about the universities? That may or may not be part of this next announcement whenever it happens.
So who's kicking in what? So what's the holdup?
Yeah, this is a good question. You know, the mayor himself has said there were technical aspects of this whole thing that I probably should have seen were going to be an issue, and they have indeed been holding us back. He cited two. One he cited on the air with you, which is that the attempt to lure Amazon's second headquarters really kind of goosed the numbers, because Amazon itself, part of the city's pitch to Amazon is, we'll take some of your wage tax money and use that to kind of underwrite these same kinds of causes, mm-hmm. whether they be affordable housing or what have you. Amazon then, of course, didn't decide to come to Pittsburgh, and so all that stuff is off the table. And the mayor basically said that kind of really disrupted the whole process of figuring out how much money we would need and where it would come from.
Yeah, but he said all along that it wasn't contingent upon Amazon coming to Pittsburgh.
Yes, and that's what he would say is that what he said yesterday is it just messed with the numbers. Amazon was supposed to pay into this. If they had come, it would have been one amount of money. If they had not come, it would have been another. The other thing he said, and we haven't gotten into, is the city, the whole way One Pittsburgh is supposed to work is to have a nonprofit that takes the money in and spends it out.
Right.
The city's idea originally was to use the Sprout Fund, which sort of contributed to those murals that you see right. around town. The Sprout Fund basically went dark last year. They kind of sunsetted. The mayor is hoping to use their 501c3 license or designation or whatever right. and make that the vehicle. There are apparently legal issues with that.
All right. So what difference does it really make if the plan takes a little more time to get all those pieces in order?
I mean, the problem is the mayor has been talking about this in one way or another since 2014, since the early days of his administration. Nonprofits like UPMC used to contribute millions of dollars in payment of lieu of taxes, money they'd give directly right. to the city instead of paying property tax. They haven't done that for years now. So we have been missing that money in the budget. It's not a huge amount, but $5 million here, $5 million there, it adds up. So we've been missing that money. And meanwhile, these needs continue. Affordable housing is an issue in the city. As the city grows, it will become even more of an issue going forward. So That's the situation we're in now, and it's just a question of, you know, how much longer can we be expected to wait? How many more of these assurances can we get before people really start to get kind of cynical about it?
Chris Potter is the editor of WESA's Government Accountability Team. Thanks so much, Chris.
Thank you for having me.
A compensation fund for victims of abuse in the Pittsburgh Diocese is to begin later this month. What's the potential impact for victims and the diocese? That's coming up a little later on The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. It's The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. President Trump has promised he would bring back coal jobs, specifically mentioning Pennsylvania in June 2017.
The miners of Pennsylvania, we're digging coal again. When I campaigned for president, I said that we would end the war on coal and put our incredible miners, and that's what you are, you're incredible, back to work.
That was good news to the anthracite coal regions of northeastern Pennsylvania. For Keystone Crossroads, Jen Kinney reports on how the economy is faring midway through Trump's first term.
Tom Majeka's house in Monoy City faces a row of empty lots. Row homes once stood here, but they suffered the fate of many buildings in this once booming coal town. A fire, then rubble, now blight.
Our biggest issues are blighted buildings.
But Majakis, who has lived his whole life in Monoy City and is now the borough council president, is hopeful.
We're not dead yet. We still got a pulse here in Monoy City. Thank God that Trump, you know, lifted all the regulations on coal. It's going to be coal again. Coal's going to be king.
This is anthracite coal country, a region of northeastern Pennsylvania that's unique for a particularly pure, high-carbon form of coal. At its peak in the early 1900s, over 200,000 people worked the mines here, including many of Monoy City's 16,000 residents. Anthracite fueled the U.S. until mid-century, when the industry began to collapse. Since then, the population of Manoy City has fallen dramatically. In all of Schuylkill County, median household income is well below the state average, and just 500 people work in mining.
It just fizzled out, you know.
But Majakis points to the Blaschak Coal Company, based at the edge of town, as proof of a Trump-fueled comeback. He tells me Blaschak is reopening a mine in nearby Mount Carmel.
That's going to mean a lot of work.
This is pretty much all coal.
On a gray day under light snowfall, Blaschak CEO Greg Driscoll gives me a tour of the mine. There's a conveyor belt dumping coal into a huge, shiny pile and a massive, nearly vertical pit in the ground.
You can actually see the black there. That's the beginning of the coal vein.
At the beginning of the 20th century, this was your classic underground mine, with mine shafts and pickaxes. It was shuttered for decades, then intermittently used for surface mining. Operations ceased for nearly 20 years, and now, with help from a state grant, work has just recently resumed.
This is what's called the mammoth anthracite seam. It's called mammoth because it's the biggest.
Blaschak is blasting away the rock to get at the remaining coal seam. Driscoll estimates it could yield $450 million worth of coal over the next 20 years.
It was once 100 million tons a year in this area. Today it's about 2 million tons. But we think it could be 10 million tons, you know, and that would certainly be a major benefit to the economy, to employment, to a future, to building a future in the region.
That would be a big deal. But what about today? Are Trump's promises to cut regulations impacting Blaschak's new mine and boosting the economy? The short answer, no.
Not directly. We have not seen a big impact from any changes in the last 3 or 4 years.
Nationwide, there has been a slight increase in mining jobs since Trump took office. But experts say that's due to market forces, not regulation cutting. And in Pennsylvania, according to the Department of Environmental Protection, the trend's still downward. That's confusing to people. When news of the Mount Carmel mine reopening broke, local news stations made it sound like it would bring dozens of new jobs.
That site is the largest new mine development in the region. The project is expected to bring 30 jobs to the Mount Carmel area.
Charlie Gasparetti is one of those workers.
This is a good job that they have going here now. You know, it's a lot of coal. Knock on wood, everything goes great. And I should be able to get close to retirement out of this job.
But Gasparetti and all of the workers here were transferred from another mine that Blaschak had just closed, only a few miles away. Those media reports about new jobs got it wrong, says Driscoll. So far, there are no new jobs.
We try to make it clear that, you know, this is what's happening right now. There could be another 25 jobs, you know, if we are able to get this developed and opened up and we see the market, you know, available to us.
People who know coal say projects like this maintain employment in the sector, a good thing for the economy. But that promised coal revolution?
Coal is not coming back. Coal in the U.S. will never come back.
Art Sullivan has worked in coal for 52 years, starting as a miner. Now he's a mining consultant in western Pennsylvania, and he says people in the country's coal regions have been misled.
Trump is a liar. Trump gave hope to a group of people who I respect, admire, and have spent my working career with. He lied to them because they were desperate for hope.
For Blaschak CEO Driscoll, the hope for a new coal boom is tied to new innovations. Anthracite can be used in filtration and water purification. People are experimenting with extracting its rare minerals, all of which has the potential to create a new coal economy.
The long-term challenge is still the same, though, and is what can we do to turn this into more of a contributor to long-term redevelopment of the region?
How you doing?
Hey, good. Nice
good, good. Hey.
Back in Manoy City, Tom Majakis, the borough president, was surprised to learn that the new Blaschak mine hasn't yet brought new jobs.
No, that I didn't know. I just assumed that, you know, they're going to be out there doing that.
There are some positive signs of life in town. Residents and local experts say manufacturing jobs are plentiful in the region. But questions remain about how to revive old coal towns like this, with shrinking populations and crumbling housing. The people who do find jobs here tend to live elsewhere in the region, away from the blight of Manoy City. Majakis, though, remains optimistic.
Not just Monterey City. I do believe the small towns in these areas, everything is going to turn around eventually.
How long that will take, he doesn't know. For Keystone Crossroads, I'm Jen Kinney.
You're listening to The Confluence. It's The Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. The compensation fund created by the Diocese of Pittsburgh for survivors abused as children by Catholic clergy is expected to open its application process later this month. Can cash payments help ease victims' pain? Could settlements help stave off bankruptcy for the diocese? Two reporters with the Tribune Review have been trying to answer these questions and more. Jamie Martinez and Aaron Opperly, welcome to The Confluence.
Great to be here, Kevin.
Thanks for having us.
All right. Before we discuss the possible implications for both survivors and the diocese, Aaron, Jamie, a few details, please, if you would. How many across the state dioceses have set up or are in the process of setting up compensation funds?
It's nearly everyone. I think the Altoona Johnstown Diocese is the only one that isn't doing a fund that we're going to see roll out in Pittsburgh. Philadelphia has already started right. their fund. We're going to see them from Scranton, Harrisburg, Greensburg, Erie. I may be missing one, but it's a majority of the diocese.
Do we know how much money is being sunk into these funds at this point, or is that being kept quiet?
We don't know. The Philadelphia Archdiocese has said that they're going to put aside at least $25 to $30 million, but so far, no one else has come out with a hard number.
Mm-hmm. So from your reporting, what have you learned about where the Diocese of Pittsburgh plans to get the revenues to sink into this fund?
What we learned is that they're going to use money that they have either saved up from past property sales of diocesan assets. So think old orphanages that have closed down and they've sold off, or any possible future sales. There's been a long talk about possibly selling the property they have downtown on Boulevard of the Allies, taking that money and putting some of those dollars into the fund.
Mm-hmm. You've done a series of reports in the past week on all kind of aspects of this issue. Pittsburgh Bishop David Zubik, in your story, called the fund the best option for recovery and healing. So what reactions have you gotten from victims or their attorneys that, you know, you've heard comment on this?
It really goes survivor to survivor, everyone kind of making the best decision for their situation. Some people have told us that they don't want any part of the funds because they want their day in court. They want to be able to publicly speak with their accuser, take them to court, try to get some sort of legal action, depending on, you know, what could be available to them, depending on the timeline of their abuse. Other people have said, you know what, this is a way for me to have my case heard, have it acknowledged, and maybe something good will come out of it. I've had one survivor tell me that if her fund goes through, she plans to donate the money to an organization. So it really depends on person to person and what would work best for their situation.
I had another survivor tell me that when the letter comes, if it comes to him to participate in the fund, he's not even going to dignify it with a response. He wants to take his case to court. He hopes that Pennsylvania changes the law to allow his old case to come forward. He wants that judicial avenue. You know, both Jamie and I felt it was important to try to figure out how people were reacting to this, to go to other states where they have done these compensation programs. Pennsylvania isn't the first, and so we talked to attorneys who have handled cases in New York and worked with victims and survivors who've gone through the New York diocese. And it varies from person to person. For some, the money is a welcomed relief. For others, they've turned this money down.
Mm-hmm. So is it the fact that some want that to be able to, you know, sit across from the people who victimized them, or at least the diocese who maybe moved around priests who were abusing, and others, you know, it's a chance to finish off and healing, you know, in a sense, quietly, if you would.
Sure. If you go with the fund, the survivor has control over privacy. It's as public as they want to make it. The diocese that we've spoken to, including Pittsburgh, aren't barring survivors from speaking about the claims process and going through the fund process, but they can choose to keep it quiet as well. The benefit that some survivors have told us of going to court is that all the details come out and there will be a discovery process and there's a chance to hold whoever might be involved accountable for what happened to them.
So to clarify and follow up, so you're saying that with the compensation fund, if a victim of a survivor wants to participate that way, they can still talk about it.
Mm-hmm, absolutely.
So it's not signing a paper, I've got to keep my mouth shut.
Right.
Okay. What about attorneys? You've talked to a variety of attorneys that have handled cases in the past in other states and have clients in Pennsylvania. What are they talking about advice that they're giving to clients?
Attorneys have raised a couple of concerns. One is that the amount that these funds typically pay out, and that's anywhere from $25,000 to $500,000, so huge range, and we don't know specifics on each individual case. That money is typically less than they could potentially get if they were able to go to court. On the flip side, they can't go to court right now under the current statute of limitation laws. So the victims have to weigh that. They're upset. They think the Catholic churches in some areas could pay more. They're also concerned that by sort of the church advocating these victim compensation funds,
right.
It's a way for the church to continue to keep this scandal quiet and to sweep it under the rug because it's not going to court. It's not in this public forum. They're handling these cases, each one, and can dispense of them quietly.
Jamie and Aaron, I noted in your reporting, at least in one of the stories, that you spoke with a Boston-based attorney who was actually featured in the movie Spotlight about the scandal in the Boston Archdiocese. What did you hear from him?
Mitch, yeah, He's been working in the area of clergy sexual abuse for decades. He was one of the attorneys to bring one of the first cases in Boston against the Archdiocese there. Mitch was really one of the guys that brought forward a lot of these concerns about the church being able to stay quiet. He had some very strong words for the church and characterized the church in a very negative light. But then he's very compassionate towards the victims, and he understands that victims, for some of them, this is the relief that they need. This is the course they want to go down. He left me with a really strong statement saying that, no amount of money, whether you go to court or not, is ever going to really heal or to bring back the lives that are taken through sexual abuse. And he never would disparage any victim from pursuing one course or another.
Jamie, you also spoke to attorneys for reporting. What sort of message did you get from them?
I would say about the same, that every survivor is in a different situation. They're a different stage of their life and a different stage of the healing process. And whichever course they decide to pursue is really up to them.
As Aaron alluded to, jury verdicts obviously can and often do pay out more than any compensation fund. But what happens if dioceses go bankrupt? What's going to happen here?
Well, that's something we wanted to take a look at, because when reporters and editors from the Tribune Review had a chance to sit down with the bishop of the Greensburg Diocese, one of the things that he said was that they were pursuing this compensation fund route in order to avoid bankruptcy. So that obviously raised the question of what would a bankruptcy look like. And I think Minnesota is a great state to look at in terms of widespread bankruptcies. Minnesota changed their statute of limitation laws a couple years ago to allow old cases. They opened up a three-year window. That led to bankruptcies in five of their six dioceses, including the Archdiocese of St. Paul and Minneapolis. What we found through talking to the diocese there is that they did have to cut staff. They did have to sell off some property. But masses continued, essential services continued. The average parishioner really didn't see a big change in their day-to-day life because of those bankruptcies.
One of the questions we hear, okay, the church will go on, the congregants might not see it, but what about the charitable organizations that benefit from funds that dioceses sort of distribute that are not necessarily related to the diocese themselves?
We've been told that charitable funds won't be touched, parish funds won't be touched. The thing that makes it difficult in our reporting is there's only so much that the church has to disclose and only so much that we can see from being outside of the church. So we're looking into it and we're trying to figure out what those numbers might look like and where else money could be coming from, but it's difficult.
Go ahead, Aaron.
One of the reasons we found, or one of the interesting things we found in Minnesota was, as these dioceses were going through the bankruptcy process, some of the victims wanted to be able to include individual parishes or schools in the total amount of the bankruptcy. And it actually went up into the federal court system, and they ruled that those are separate and distinct entities and couldn't be included in the diocesan bankruptcy. So there is some federal court law that, you know, keeps those aspects of the church separate from what the diocese is dealing with.
To clarify, so they couldn't sue the individual parish, just the diocese? Is that what I'm hearing?
The individual parish could not be included with the diocese.
So as a defendant?
As a defendant, as part of the assets. So okay. When you talk about what is the diocese worth, it's worth what itself is worth, not the total of parishes and schools.
All right. So last month, shortly after the Pittsburgh Diocese announced it would create the compensation fund, my colleague on the Confluence, Megan Harris, spoke with Camille Biros, who, along with attorney Kenneth Feinberg, is administering the compensation fund. So why did the Pittsburgh Diocese choose this Washington-based firm?
Well, I asked Bishop Zubik that exact question. He told me it was because of their proven track record. I asked Mr. Feinberg why he was chosen, and he said something very similar. It's because we have a proven track record. And Mr. Feinberg's been working in this field for decades. It started with his work mediating a settlement with Vietnam veterans who were exposed to Agent Orange. And from there, his career sort of built. The next big thing, he worked on the September 11th fund and administered several high-profile funds since then.
Mm-hmm. So what did you learn about a time frame for applying for this Pittsburgh Diocese Compensation Fund? Is there a certain window when people can apply for it?
The last information that we heard was that something would be kicking off by the end of this month, and then there would be kind of a 60 to 90 day window for administering it. So there's still more details that we need to see come out.
Mm-hmm. Aaron mentioned earlier about other compensation funds, and the payments had a wide range. Is there a scale when you talk to Camille Biros or someone else? Is there a sort of a scale for, you know, you were abused this much or what? I mean, how do they decide this?
They take all those factors into account, and we published in the Trib on Sunday a pretty exhaustive list of sort of what those factors are when they decide. But they really take each case on its own, look at the severity of the abuse, the type of the abuse, over how long did it happen, how many times, and set the amount. And there is a process by which the person who could get that money can say, I don't know if I'm getting enough, and they can go back to Feinberg and Biros and have a discussion to try to get more, and attorneys play a role there.
All right, Jamie, briefly, I want to, we've been talking a lot about clergy abuse, but you reported that this fund does not cover abuse by religious orders, brothers, or even lay people who work for the diocese.
Right, exactly. So when we're talking about clergy abuse, we're talking about priests within the diocese. That says nothing of members of religious orders, Marianists, for example, who work in schools, teachers, janitors, anyone, any adult who might have been working in a school and having contact with kids and potentially abusing them within this environment. And they will not be included in the Pittsburgh Fund. Now, that does vary from diocese to diocese. They're each setting their own standards. Erie, for example, is including lay individuals like teachers. Greensburg has also said that they're going to include religious order priests. So it really varies by diocese.
And final quick question. Still many questions. And I guess the big question is whether the state legislature will pass a window of opportunity where the statute of limitations has expired.
I've talked to some people who are very optimistic that that will happen. Other people remain committed against it. Some of the leadership in Harrisburg remain committed against it. So it's a new year. It's a new legislature. I guess we'll just have to see.
All right. Jamie Martinez and Aaron Opperly are reporters for the Pittsburgh Tribune Review. Thanks so much for joining us today.
Thanks a lot.
Thanks for having us.
And we look forward to your continued coverage.
And for today, that is the confluence where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. Next time, challenges and opportunities for Black business owners and their employees. We'll visit with Doris Carson Williams, President and CEO of the African American Chamber of Commerce. Today's program was engineered and produced by Kylie Kaczynski. Production assistance by Meg Fair. The editor and producer of The Confluence is Megan Harris. I'm Kevin Gavin. Until next time, hope you have a good weekend of good news.